Aloha. It's Tuesday, July 14th. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. The mystery of the vanishing mango season. We hear from a longtime grower about a surprising impact of the Konolo storms that battered our islands 4 months ago. We learn more about alleged campaign finance violations made by Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke's campaign. What do insiders think of her campaign's bookkeeping? From committing to clean energy to flip-flopping back to fossil fuels, we dive deep into the state's plunge into liquefied natural gas. We hear the song of a chattering hill robin that is a popular cage bird on this week's Manu Minute. And we survey the landscape for cancer care in the islands, how a new hub for clinical trials aims to counteract financial toxicity and brain drain.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. We've reached midsummer, normally the peak of our much-awaited mango season in the islands. Sadly, our local mangoes took a hit from a windy February coupled with heavy rain from the Konolo storms in March. This morning, we asked Mark Suiso of Makaha Mangoes what's going on. His family farm has more than 60 trees and 15 varieties, including some that are more than 60 years old. He explains what caused the damage and offers tips for us backyard growers. You know, normally we're at the peak of mango season around this time. What happened?
Yeah, this was a perfect storm. I mean, mangoes are a summer fruit. And like you said, it's normally we're July, we should have a lot of mangoes. And what happened this year is we had a lot of wind early in February that knocked off a lot of the flowers and leaves on the trees. And that was followed quickly by a lot of rain. And so the trees were off cycle. And what happened is without leaves, the trees aren't really happy. So priority went to producing new leaves. And if it's producing leaves, it's not producing flowers. And then it takes those new leaves about 4 to 6 months to really get to the point where they can produce flowers again. So we lost everything in March. If you drive around the island, you'll see a few of the trees are starting to have a few flowers. And so that's coming means you're going to be picking mangoes in November. So this is one of those years where you're not going to get an abundance of fruit at one time. And you got very little in the normal season, but you got a really late season coming in. And it's going to be a little bit at a time. So I normally pick at this time of the year, I'm picking maybe 300-400 pounds a day. I picked maybe just shy of 50 pounds today. And that's because of the stragglers that somehow weathered that heavy storm and we're able to mature. The flowers that are coming up now, it's going to take you another 3 or 4 months before we get to pick them. So I'm picking a little bit every year right up into November. And I think that's kind of a statewide phenomenon.
For sure, because you're in Makaha, where you're known for that sunny weather and the soil that is perfect for mangoes normally.
Yeah, so that's the thing is mangoes are, dry side crop. I tell people sunlight and airflow, everything else is a poor substitute. And this year, with all that humidity from all that rain, we've had problems with mangoes that normally we don't have. And all that extra humidity led to all these black spots that people kept complaining about this year. And that's because of the humidity. And there's not much you can do about that. It's being a sunny area and, maximize the sunlight, maximize the airflow. And you shouldn't have trouble with the black spots, but because of all that humidity, we did. And I have trees with lots of black spots earlier in the year. I'm picking in May and it was just covered with black spots. But now that the summer weather is out there, that same tree has fruit with no black spots at all, which is normal for me.
How was it there during the storm? Were your trees affected directly?
Oh, yeah. So in February, we had this wind and a friend of mine was clocking that wind at about 80 miles an hour. I've seen trees moving around that look like a hurricane. You know, the whole tree is moving back and forth. Not too many broken branches because, you know, my trees are kind of maintained pretty well, but all the leaves were stripped off. And I drive through the neighborhoods and some of these bigger trees that were exposed to the strong winds were broken. And it's not just mango. All the trees were exposed to that heavy wind. And then after that heavy wind, we had all that rain. I didn't have as much as some places. I had a total of 15 inches of rain during that period of time. And I've had rain like that before. But because the trees were so damaged and had no leaves, it just went to producing new leaf. So if you recall back then, all the trees in the whole island, the whole state maybe, were all producing leaves at that time.
Do you have any idea of overall mango industry?
Yeah, so it's kind of disturbing to me. You know, I would say two generations ago, everyone had a mango tree and everyone had so much, they were just giving it away to all their neighborhoods. They had too many mangoes. In fact, there's a little book, I would encourage everyone to get it. It's called Too Many Mangoes. It's made by Island Heritage. And that's how it used to be. We're not like that anymore. So there's a handful of us that do have mango trees and everybody, you know, expects that person to provide the mango trees for them. And it's kind of tilted. So there's so many people without mango trees, depending on the few people that have the mango trees. So they're getting to the point where I don't get mangoes anymore. So now we're going to the stores and we're buying mangoes and it's costing close to $6 a pound for mangoes at the grocery stores. And some of the mangoes are locally produced, but most of the mangoes are brought in from somewhere else. And this is kind of true with produce that we buy at the stores. It's probably left the farm a month, maybe 2 months ago. And so they weren't picked ripe. And, you know, something tree-ripened fruit tastes so much better than not tree-ripened fruit. And you want tree-ripened fruit, grow your own. There's a handful of us that still maintain trees. Like you, Ralby, have your tree there. And you know what's good about you? You're on the windward side, so you know you're not in the ideal mango season. But there are varieties that do okay in the wet environments, and that Fairchild that you have is one of them. So good for you.
Yeah, thanks. Well, it's worth it. The reward of it alone is awesome.
I agree. I tell people, if you don't have a fruit tree in your yard, you have no soul. Nothing beats that.
I'll steal that line. Are there things that people are finding who were affected by this? Are there ways to, I mean, generally you look to when crops are damaged, there's things people can do with what they have left. In this case, sometimes though it was the blossoms were blown off and then the fruit was not as good as it usually is. Do you hear of any creative ways people are using what got?
I've tried a lot of tricks in my books and I would encourage people to spend a lot of time on YouTube. And, you know, one YouTube's not going to solve your problem, but spending some time in there will help you sort out what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And under ideal conditions, mangoes, like, they're what we call a subtropical fruit. They like a wet season and a dry season. And the more distinct the season is, the easier it is for the tree. And back in the old days, that's what happened. You know, we would not have any mangoes. All of a sudden, we have way too many mangoes in June and July, and we couldn't get rid of them. And then there's no mangoes after that. And because of this mix in the weather patterns, the tree goes through a normal cycle of producing leaves. 4 to 6 months after produces the leaves, there's a trigger to get it to produce flowers. And after it produces flowers, the flowers get pollinated. And after those pollinated flowers are there on the tree for a while, your fruit matures and you get ripe fruit maybe 4 to 6 months later. And then the whole cycle repeats itself. So that's sort of what you would like to duplicate as much as possible. Now, we don't have the ability to control the weather, but what I tell people is there's pruning your tree to keep it small is important. And, you know, not pruning your tree and waiting for it to get 50 feet high creates a problem because you have a lot of root underneath there. And that's where a lot of problems occur with being invasive roots. But it also needs to be fed by the tree. And, you know, the bigger the root, the bigger the tree needs to be to feed the root. So if you keep the tree small, you don't have a big root, and then you don't have to have so much leaf material. So that's a management thing. It's, you know, don't delay pruning the trees and maintaining the trees. And the other thing you want to do is make sure there's lots of sunlight. So you want to have a lot of sunlight as much as possible. And then you want to have the airflow. So if you walk under your tree and it's really dark and mosquitoes are biting you and there's a lot of dead branches in there, that's not a good idea. So what you want to do is prune it, thin it out. And, you know, what I like to do is walk underneath and you can see, you know, muddled lighting underneath there. Or some people say the bird should be able to fly through the tree. And that's what you want to do. So, you know, I think for a lot of us, our trees are too dense. And it's, you know, that density creates humidity, which leads to those black spots and disease. So if you thin it out and let the air flow through it, sunlight and airflow is what you want to maximize as much as possible.
Is there anything else you wanted to emphasize to let our listeners know that we didn't touch on?
Yeah, I would encourage people to, you know, spend some time on YouTube and looking at what's going on. Drive around your neighborhood and look at the successes that are out there. And what I'm finding is, you know, it radiates out in the neighborhood. So if you had a couple of neighbors in your area that have a really successful tree, you get to know them a little bit. And, you know, that really helps to build the neighborhood. And then, you know, whatever tricks they're doing. But the biggest thing is you don't want to let the tree get too big. It's just really difficult to deal with a tree that's gotten too big. And if your tree already got too big, some people will try to bring it down. It's a struggle to do that. I don't often have success bringing a tree down and making it productive. Some people just accept the mango tree as a, you know, that's the dominant tree. It's a legacy tree. And they use it primarily for the shade. And you can try to bring it down. It's just difficult. Often it's starting all over again, and very few people are willing to do that. So you get the small trees, you maintain it. Don't let it get over the height of your roof, and you'll have a tree for a long time. Just don't let it get too big.
That was Mark Suiso, owner of Makaha Mangoes and president of Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers. For backyard growers, he suggests trimming just 20 to 30% of the tree leaves at a time and adding potassium to the soil, not nitrogen. Find more tips on the web, on YouTube, and at makahamangoes.com.
Support for HPR comes from Queen's, providing neurosurgical and neurointerventional care for Hawaii. Their multidisciplinary team supports patients with complex neurological conditions. Queens.org/neurosurgery.
Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke may be on the hook for her campaign's sloppy bookkeeping. The state's campaign finance watchdog found numerous violations after intense scrutiny. Some say the unreported donations and expenditures are unacceptable. Others call them simple mistakes. Ultimately, it's Hawaii Attorney General Ann Lopez's call. Here to fill us in on the details is Madeline Valera of Civil Beat. Good morning, Madeline.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for joining us right in the middle of your workday. We appreciate that.
Yes, no problem.
Why don't you update us first on what are the main problems that did come up in your story about Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke's campaign?
Yes, so in a campaign spending commission complaint that was filed in May, investigators found, you know, that her campaign had failed to report more than $50,000 in expenditures. They had reported more than $30,000 in contributions years after receiving them. There were issues such as, you know, hundreds of checks that were signed off on by people on the campaign who were not designated as treasurers, which is a violation of campaign finance rules. So there were numerous issues that they found that, when taken as a whole, you know, they said at a meeting last week, seemed very serious.
So why are these accounting issues coming out now? As you said, it's been years.
Yes. Well, Sylvia Luke actually released an audit of her own campaign a couple of months ago, and that also found some contributions that had been missing, previously unreported. So the Campaign Spending Commission took it a step further, did more investigating, and found even more issues, and, you know, found these tens of thousands of dollars that had been unreported in amended reports. So they, you know, took the extra step, they filed a complaint, and the commission last week voted to refer that complaint to the Attorney General's office. So now it's in the AG's hands.
I got it. So it was she, her own audit had brought out some irregularities, and then they probed to see, the Attorney General's office probed to see what went beyond that, and campaign spending.
Or the campaign spending commission, yes. Did, yeah. And now, sorry. Yes, now they've sent it to the AG's office, which I expect will take it up.
And can you remind us what the status of Sylvia Luke is now?
Oh, yes. She's still the lieutenant governor, but she's been on unpaid leave for some months now after she announced that she is a target in the AG's other investigation into a $35,000 in a paper bag that was given to someone that we only know was called an influential lawmaker. So we don't know much more about what's going on with that, but we know that the AG was looking into her as well. So she's been on unpaid leave in the meantime.
Yeah, I'm guessing that would be a whole different story if you found out more about the paper bag and full of money.
Yes, yes. So these campaign finance violations are separate, but kind of in the same territory. So, you know, we'll see how it all comes together.
I think one of the things that seems surprising in reading your story today online was that I covered Sylvia Luke as a lawmaker known to ask tough questions and require those who came before her to provide very detailed accounting when she headed House Finance. Are campaigns known for precision or sloppiness in general? I mean, is this typical?
Yeah, so I spoke to many people who ran their own campaigns or who worked on campaigns, and they said this is not typical. Like, while it is very complicated, of course, the process, and campaigns are often run by volunteers, so yes, mistakes can be made, things can slip through the cracks, but to have so many errors and to not correct them in a timely manner, that seemed really strange to a lot of people.
And you spoke with former Governor Neil Abercrombie, and he didn't talk specifically about Lieutenant Governor Luke, but he talked about how campaign finances were handled in his campaign. Tell us about that.
Yes, he told a really great story. This was back when he was running for state rep in the 70s. He said he would drive around in a yellow, kind of like a famous New York yellow taxi cab, but it was his campaign car and he had his name and face on the side. But one day when he was dropping a friend at the airport, he said a couple of tourists mistook him for a real taxi and jumped in the back and said, "Hey, can you take us to the Inter Island Terminal?" So he said, okay, drove them. He said the drive was only something like 20 seconds. He let them out. They tried to give him a $10 bill, which he tried to refuse, but they just ended up dropping it on the seat, wishing him well and running off. So he took that $10 bill, he said, and drove back to his makeshift headquarters in Manoa, you know, gave it to his volunteer treasurer and said, "Log this as an anonymous donation from Alaska." So that was just to illustrate, you know, how every cent needs to be accounted for.
Right. So many people do take campaign finances very seriously. Well, thank you, Madeline. I really appreciate your letting us know more about the story behind the story.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right. Take care.
We've been talking to Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Madeline Valera. Read her story online at civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Tomorrow, we'll host a call-in show to discuss the Office of Hawaiian Affairs exploration into purchasing local TV stations, KITV and KIKU. So, for today's quiz, we wanted to test how well you've been following that news. OHA recently allotted over $172,000 into a due diligence review, a step toward acquiring the two stations from Allen Media. Some say that purchase would positively impact Hawaiian representation in media. Others remain skeptical of a state agency owning a media brand. OHA's Board of Trustees was first presented with the opportunity to acquire the two stations back in May. But on a 4-5 vote, the initial proposal was ultimately rejected. Then, in June, a new phrasing of the proposal flipped the vote to 5-4. That means OHA will move forward to evaluate the acquisition of the two stations. We want to know which OHA trustee changed their mind and flip-flopped on the proposal to purchase KITV and KIKU. Hint, this trustee is the child of a prominent politician. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NareitHawaii.com.
There's a debate going on in Hawaii about a potential role for liquefied natural gas on the way to the state's clean energy future. It's a layered story with some history. And there's interest in it beyond Hawaii. That's led to a collaboration between HPR and Canary Media. HPR's Bill Dorman spoke with the reporters on the story. You'll hear from him, HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote, and Canary Media's Julian Spector. First, Bill Dorman.
Canary Media describes itself as an independent nonprofit newsroom covering the transition to clean energy and solutions to the climate crisis. HPR's worked in collaboration on a story that's out on canarymedia.com. It's got a joint byline by Julian Spector of Canary and Savannah Harriman-Pote, who is our senior reporter for climate and energy and editor at large at HPR. They're both joining us today to talk about this, and Sav, we're going to start with you. You've been covering this story for some time now. Where does it start?
Well, I mean, really, when you're talking about natural gas in Hawaii, you can go back decades. Liquefied natural gas is a fossil fuel, that's important to note, but it is generally considered to be both cheaper and cleaner than oil, and our oil dependence in Hawaii plays a big role in the high energy costs that we have. And the state has changed its stance on natural gas more than once. So if you look at Governor Linda Lingle's administration, they opposed it, but then her successor, Neil Abercrombie, advocated for it. Governor David Ige, who enacted the state law that requires us to completely phase out fossil fuels on our energy grids by 2045, came out in pretty strong opposition to natural gas about 10 years ago. And at the time, that kind of seemed like the final word on the matter. But then this conversation around natural gas started to pick up again after the Maui fires, when there were concerns that our main utility, Hawaiian Electric, might go bankrupt. And we know that JERA, which is one of the world's largest buyers of natural gas, expressed an interest in investing in HECO around that time.
And the state now has entered what the governor's office calls a strategic partnership with JERA, which is the largest producer of electricity in Japan. And in March, the governor's office shared a proposal from JERA on how the company would build a liquefied natural gas terminal off the coast of Oahu, as well as a new gas-fired power plant in Kapolei. Is it fair to say you think that JERA has been the main player when we're talking about who would actually develop a project and supply gas to Oahu?
Yes. Yeah. JERA seems to have been around since the very beginning of this chapter of the natural gas conversation. And Governor Josh Green is very interested in what JERA specifically can offer Oahu. And environmental groups like Earth Justice and Life of the Land actually procured email and text chains through public records requests that show that the Hawaii State Energy Office, the governor's office, and IQ360, the PR company that JERA has hired locally, are really working in concert to promote this specific project. And JERA has also expressed that it wants to bypass the Hawaii Public Utility Commission's competitive bidding process. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the project wouldn't be regulated. It just means that it wouldn't necessarily be weighed against other bids from other natural gas developers.
Bit of a departure from usual practice there. Julian, you're a senior reporter with Canary Media, as we mentioned, the national outlet focusing on covering clean energy transition. This really gets into the nitty-gritty of Hawaii's energy landscape, this story does. Why would a national audience be interested in such a thing?
Sure. Well, Hawaii was the first state in the nation to legally commit to getting rid of fossil fuels from the electricity system. And that set a really important precedent that almost half of the other states followed. California came later, New York, Massachusetts, all these other states followed suit. So you can think of it as Hawaii is ahead in this process of trying to then execute on this really ambitious, really difficult pledge or promise that it made. And I think checking in on how that's going is vitally important for everyone who's hoping to eventually decarbonize their electricity systems. I personally have been covering the energy storyline in Hawaii for several years. I was there to report on the closure of the last coal plant in 2022 and the efforts to bring on solar and batteries and try to show that you can actually run a system and keep the lights on by only adding new clean technology. I saw the tone start pretty optimistic in the early years of that. And then a lot changed. You had the delays from COVID that set a lot of the big solar projects back. You had global wars that are changing the oil price and spiking that, like when the Ukraine war started and now the Iran war. And you saw what happens to an energy transition when not everything goes according to plan, when unexpected setbacks kick in and the going gets tough. And I thought that was something really important that a lot of other states are also grappling with in their own ways. And so we wanted to take the time to tell this story about this LNG project in a long and detailed and hopefully insightful feature.
Appreciate that. Also, the wrestling with volatile energy prices. Now we're back at that in another round of that. Certainly, affordability, importance of concept, but it's also become sort of a political buzzword now about reporting about this, about how energy costs affecting Hawaii households. Sav, I know that you've done a lot on this.
Yeah, I would say that word affordability is buzzy, but it's also real. And so Hawaii notoriously has the highest electricity rates in the country. As we've talked about, oil plays a really big role in that. And so one of the things that we looked at in our reporting is every month, Hawaiian Electric shares its rates with the Public Utilities Commission. So it's a snapshot of what people are actually paying. And it includes an estimate of how much a customer who uses 500 kilowatt hours of electricity might pay. And that's the amount of energy is what you need if you live in an apartment or a small house. And so in May 2015, shortly before we adopted our clean energy mandate, that customer was paying about $140. And then in May 2026, that same customer using the same amount of energy was paying more than $250. It's important to note that the costs in May 2026, where we took that little picture, were especially high because of increased oil prices due to the closure and blockades in the Strait of Hormuz. But that, again, also demonstrates this ongoing volatility with oil prices that Hawaii has really had to deal with. And so a lot of people have been able to lower their energy costs with rooftop solar, but if you don't have one of those systems, and many people still don't, so far, I think what we found in our reporting is the renewable energy transition has not spared you from high energy costs. And I think there is a general consensus at this point among different folks that we've talked to that the price volatility of oil is bad. It's something that we need to get away from. What people disagree on is where we go from here and how we can achieve savings for people.
You know, and that really goes to the point of analysis. And Julian, a lot of your work on this has focused on conflicting analyses about the cost savings of liquefied natural gas. What can you walk us through on that one a little bit?
Sure. So it really starts with the Hawaii State Energy Office, which had their own study that was looking at a range of different energy possibilities, but ended up coming out with the conclusion that they thought LNG would be the best for cleaning up in the energy system and saving money on the way to the 2045 clean energy deadline. Now, that came under fire in March when someone named Matthias Fripp, who's an analyst at the think tank Energy Innovations, testified at the state legislature in what was really one of the more dramatic legislative testimonies I've witnessed. He said that he had dug into the spreadsheets that the state energy office used and found some major errors that ended up drastically overstating the savings that LNG would deliver. So that kicked off a whole bit of a firestorm as everyone tried to figure out what was wrong there. And then the state energy office did end up retracting its initial main scenario about LNG and rerunning its numbers and coming up with a revised report coming out of that. Separately, JERA, the big Japanese energy company, has its own calculations, and they've been talking about delivering 20% savings for energy costs that would translate to about $500 a year per household. So, you know, that's a serious chunk of money, especially these days with all these costs being so high. But a different analyst, Rick Rosciolo from the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute, he's run his own calculations using JERA's assumptions and found that those savings are, he thought, flawed, and that the actual savings a residential customer could expect would be significantly lower. So then there's another group that's also studying this at the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization. And they did a deep analysis and found that actually really investing in solar and batteries would save money, and that the LNG is not the best way to go for reducing energy costs in the long run. But there's another problem, is that the report had to be withdrawn last week when the author acknowledged several errors, including there was actually a bit of AI hallucination that ended up in a kind of correction to an earlier issue. And then he did a deep dive and found other errors that he thought he had to just pull that study and check everything out. So what you end up here with is, it's hard to find a good clean analysis that hasn't had to retract something kind of important. And I think that's been a really big problem when this is clearly the biggest project on the table for the state's energy landscape. And people are wondering where they can get some good info on it.
And we're awaiting the Public Utilities Commission in Hawaii to perhaps help that out in terms of analysis. One other layer on that, Honolulu Civil Beats reported that Matthias Fripp's employer, Energy Innovation Policies and Solutions, which describes itself as a nonpartisan energy and climate policy think tank, has Financial Times to the Climate Imperative Foundation, which has contributed to opponents against the Green Administration's LNG proposal, including the Sierra Club, Earth Justice. The Climate Imperative Foundation, also a contributor, we should say, to Canary Media. Canary Media discloses donors who contribute more than $5,000, and the Climate Imperative Foundation makes that list. How do you respond to people who say that the financial support like that could give the appearance of a conflict of interest or even undermine analysis?
Yeah, well, I should say first, so, you know, Climate Imperative funds a lot of groups that are working on climate solutions. Here at Canary Media, we report on climate solutions. That said, our funders, we have many funders, and none of them have a say in what we write and in our editorial process. That's all separate, and we check our facts and do our own thinking, do our own writing. In the case of what this means for Fripp, so he works for a think tank that's working on climate solutions, and they are funded in large part by this philanthropy that is interested in climate solutions. I don't think that changes what we know about anyone's motivations. And it also doesn't change that the errors he called out led the Hawaii State Energy Office to redo their report and, you know, change some of the claims they were making about how much LNG would save. So, you know, hey, we're journalists. It's important to check up what biases or motivations anyone might have. But I think the real story here in terms of the public interest is just making sure that the decision on whether or not to do this LNG is made with sound reasoning, good evidence, and not with a flawed study. And, you know, it seems like everyone is agreeing on that. And the question is just, can we get that good and uncontroversial analysis?
That was HPR's Bill Dorman talking with climate and energy reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote and Canary Media's Julian Spector. The pair took a look at Hawaii's plan to import liquefied natural gas, or LNG. Look for the article at hawaiipublicradio.org. Today's Manu Minute spotlights a bird just over 5 inches in length, from beak to tail, small enough to sit comfortably in the palm of your hand. But don't underestimate this little bird. Its songs pack a punch. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the red-billed leothrix.
Red-billed leothrix are one of the prettiest non-native birds that live in Hawaii. While their body feathers are mostly grayish-green, both males and females have a golden yellow throat, red, orange, and yellow stripes on their wings, and, as their name implies, bright red bills. Leothrix are native to Southeast Asia and southern China and were introduced first to the island of Kauai as cage birds in the early 1900s. By the 1920s, they are one of the most common birds in the lowland forests of Kauai and on most of the other main Hawaiian islands a few decades after that. Strangely, they seem to have gone extinct on Kauai, even though they're still common on most of the other islands and are resistant to mosquito-transmitted diseases like avian malaria that are causing sharp declines in our native bird species. Even though leothrix spend most of their time foraging within just a few meters of the forest floor, they can be very hard to find because they're usually in dense shrubs and small trees. Because of this, they're more often heard than seen. They have three main kinds of vocalizations. The first has a variety of notes and is sung by males during breeding season to attract females. A second song is much simpler and is sung by both sexes throughout the year. The third is more of an aggressive, scolding chatter call that's directed at humans or other intruders when they get too close. It sounds a bit like a harsh rattle. If you hear that last sound, you know an angry leothrix is nearby. Leothrix are common in lowland forests dominated by non-native trees, and in high-elevation forests where the trees and shrubs are almost all native. Because they're such active fruit eaters, leothrix are major dispersers of a variety of seeds, including those from native plants that no longer have other birds to disperse their fruits. Unfortunately, though, leothrix are also one of the major dispersers of invasive plant seeds, such as clydemia, myconia, and strawberry guava, into the remaining native forests of Hawaii. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, working to protect Hawaii's native birds through programs and projects such as its Kolea Count. Learn more about programs and volunteering at hiaudubon.org.
And now it's time to explore the answer to today's quiz. Earlier today, we asked for the name of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs trustee who switched positions on the vote to conduct due diligence on the purchase of TV stations KITV and KIKU. Fun fact, this trustee comes from a family of politicians and worked full-time as a bar manager at KO's Waikiki before running for office in 2000. The trustee we were looking for, John D. Waihe'e IV. And we have a winner. Alice Tucker of Honolulu knew that the son of former Governor John Waihe'e cited financial reasons for his original vote, believing the money used to investigate the media deal could be used on something better. After the source of funding changed, then Trustee Waihe'e changed the title tide of the vote. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to us at talkback@hawaii.org. hawaiipublicradio.org, and tune into the conversation tomorrow at 11 a.m. for our special call-in show about OHA's media ambitions and the future of journalism in Hawaii. The University of Hawaii Cancer Center unveiled a new center for early stage clinical trials last week. The Ho'ola Early Phase Clinical Research Center is the first dedicated center in the islands for stage 1 and 2 clinical trials for cancer. The milestone comes as a new study finds that Hawaii cancer patients may be suffering from financial toxicity. Think of it like the harsh side effects of chemotherapy, but on your wallet. UH researchers found that Hawaii residents spend tens of millions of dollars each year on out-of-state cancer care. Leaders hope that the new clinical research center will convince some to remain in the islands for treatment. Naoto Ueno is the director of the UH Cancer Center and an author of the new research. He spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender about the study and the new research center. Ueno starts by defining financial toxicity.
The abstract that we presented at American Society of Clinical Oncology is about financial toxicity by leaving the islands. And of course, insurance may cover, but they're not going to cover everything, which include like air fee or staying somewhere else or loss of work while you're going somewhere else. So that is a side effect, right? It's a sequence or effect coming from the treatment that you're choosing or consultation. So that's what financial toxicity is about.
And you looked between 2021 and 2023 at basically insurance billing, at administrative claims, so what people had been spending on healthcare. And what you found was that on average, Hawaii residents were spending more than $50 million per year on cancer care out of state. And considering that there are fewer than 80,000 cancer patients in Hawaii, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. The study is only focused on one commercial entity. And there was a peak of like spending about $90 million per year. And with 3-year accumulation, it's up to $230 million. And we're talking about only the cost of the actual patient care, right? And then there's multiple commercial insurers as well as Medicare, Medicaid. So you could imagine that it's a lot of money Hawaii is spending outside of the state. And we talk about it, but this is the first time that we have some quantified number, how much we're spending money outside of the state.
But did that number surprise you as someone working in this space? Because it points to essentially this finding that a lot of cancer patients are going out of state for cancer care. And that's something you've noticed.
Yeah, it was not a surprise to me. What was surprise was I was expecting even higher number. But obviously, this is one commercial entity, so we don't know what as an entire Hawaii what it is, but it's a start. It's a significant amount of money spent.
So let's talk about the reasons why. Well, some of it seems like it's not so much a choice of there isn't supply, but you think that there's an additional subset of people who can make the choice to stay in state and yet are choosing to seek options on the continent.
Right. So clearly, like you just said, there's two categories. Because we don't have the enough service and they need a much more highly specialized care. And those are reflected by blood cancer. We have blood cancer specialists and they do a good job, but clearly some of them need like bone marrow transplant. And we don't have the detailed data about how it's done, but blood cancer came on a higher level of the spending. We noticed that. The other is like neuro-oncology, like brain tumor. That's another one that we don't have enough specialists. But the surprise part is breast cancer spending or lung cancer where we have specialists, but they're leaving. So this is completely speculating. I think it's a matter of confidence. And I kind of could say this because I'm a breast cancer specialist. I have patients who just say simply the moment they were diagnosed with breast cancer, they jump off the islands and they go to the continent. And why do they go? Because their friend says, well, it's better to go to MD Anderson, Stanford, to get a better care. It's a confidence issue for our care that we provide.
But then in the long run, I mean, what are the implications of that if folks don't get treated locally, if they go to the continent because they feel that they might get better care there?
Right. And actually, they don't always get a better care. And they find out quickly that they can't stay there for long terms. So they'll come back. So we're actually spending unnecessary money in the continent instead of us spending to our healthcare provider or reinvesting to the infrastructure or hiring more highly specialized physician. You know, the money is going somewhere else.
Well, let's bring in what seems like it could be a step toward solving this issue, which is the Ho'ola Early Phase Clinical Research Center. It opened earlier this month.
Right.
Explain to our listeners why this is as big a deal as folks in the cancer space are making it out to be.
Yeah, so one of the reasons for to get a better cancer care is to have an existence of standard care, which is a regular treatment, which is already established, but combined with clinical trials. So if the cancer is a curable disease, 100% curable, or even 90%, I wouldn't really always scream about clinical trials important, but that's not the reality, right? So early cancer could potentially get cured, but once you have a recurrence disease, most tumor is hard to cure the disease. So you need choices, which is a combination of standard care and clinical trials. So you could go back and forth. But here in Hawaii, we have clinical trials, but it's somewhat limited. And it's somewhat more for what we call the late phase, maybe more established type of clinical trials. And we don't have the early phase clinical trials. So this is an opportunity. The center is going to focus in this area. And people who have particularly advanced disease, they have potential more choices when you have a limited treatment choices.
And I can imagine there might even be two benefits here. There's what we've been talking about of patients being able to stay in state rather than seeking experimental therapies on the continent. But then something especially earlier along in clinical research that we've seen is that clinical trial populations just don't match up with what the demographics of a state like Hawaii actually look like. So do you feel like through this center, we could end up pursuing research and finding clinical populations that better represent the racial and ethnic breakdown of patients in state?
Right. FDA is very much interested to make sure that every demographic is well represented. And as you know, in the continent, clinical trials are mostly driven by white, followed by maybe Hispanic and Black. Asian, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, this three category is underrepresented. So we are the choice. We have a demographic, 80% is non-Caucasian. Of course, every population, including white, is very important. But we have opportunity to conduct clinical trials among our demographic, and this will not only help Hawaii, but all the other people who's living, like Native Hawaiian, you know, is living more outside of Hawaii, and it is an opportunity to really help all the populations.
You have one pilot phase one trial underway right now, yeah. And the goal is 30 active early phase trials by 2031.
Right.
What sorts of therapies might this center be investigating? What sorts of cancers will you be treating?
Right. So precision oncology is a future of cancer treatment. So precision meaning that you understand the cancer you understand the human body very well, so that we are precise with effective treatment. And by understanding human body, we reduce the toxicity. So we will be curating to pick treatment that is going to be helpful for the patients who lives in Hawaii. For example, we have more unique gastric cancer, more pancreatic cancer, we have liver cancer. And so there are certain, you know, we have all type of cancer, but clearly there are certain cancer that we represent more. So we have to look carefully that what are we going to bring to the island?
That was something I was thinking as you went in the study into the various types of cancers that were costing patients the most, of whether you would see like breast and pulmonary and leukemia represented in these early stage clinical trials.
Right. And one is representing a disease, but for us, it's not one clinical trials. So if the patient is in good shape and still eligible, we want to make sure that we give the second one or third one and look for that opportunity. I'd like to say that every treatment is going to be a home run, but that's not the case. But there are home run drugs. We know that cancer treatment is going through a very accelerated phase now, and recently was like pancreatic cancer. There's a really innovative treatment coming out. So those are hidden gems in the trials, and that's is something that we need to figure out which one is going to be the winner.
Finding these diamonds in right. the rough. So what else do you want patients to know about this center and about these early stage clinical trials that hopefully Hawaii will be seeing a lot more of in the coming years?
Well, we like for people to approach us. Yes, we are just started the engine and we don't have 30 clinical trials and it's a process, right? But one thing, by seeing our physicians and talking with your own current physician, it does help whether you fit with clinical trials, yes or no. And if it doesn't, if you are potentially eligible, that's when your physician or our physician should triage, should the patient go to the continent, why we try to develop this. So going back, I don't recommend the patient to just jump off the island. And I think it's important to talk with your, you know, healthcare provider to find out whether you qualify for clinical trials. And is it worth going to somewhere else, yes or no? And ultimately, what we like to see a couple years from now is that, hey, you don't have to go to MD Anderson. You could just come to, you know, University of Hawaii Cancer Center.
Dr. Uano, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Great. Thank you for inviting me.
That was UH Cancer Center Director Naoto Ueno and HPR's Maddie Bender. Ueno shared that the Ho'ola Early Phase Clinical Research Center will also help to train and recruit top talent to stay in the islands. The new center is offering for the first time a 3-year medical oncology fellowship for 2 physicians each year. We'll have links to learn more on our website after the show. That wraps us up for today. Tomorrow, we have a live call-in show planned to delve into the future of local media and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs' proposed bid to buy TV stations KITV and KIKU. Have thoughts on the proposal? Share your comments or questions for our panel on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Robbie Dingman. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.